philosophers in
space.
God created Arrakis to train the faithful.
You do not talk to me in my reality. If I want you, I'll call. Those are the rules.
Yeah, but everybody's a jerk. You, me, this jerk. That's my philosophy.
I don't like sand. It's coarse, rough, and irritating. And it gets everywhere.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space, episode 98. I'm Thomas, that's Aaron. How are you doing, Aaron?
Dude, I'm fabulous. I'm glanding witty banter and whoa, that's deep. And I'm ready to crush this podcasting game. How you doing, my culture friend?
Good. I'm ready to wager. I'm going to do a very dire bodily wager.
Okay.
One wet willy.
Ooh. Is that if I don't successfully the culture is the great one supreme utopia?
No, just based on this weird board game that we're going to play.
Okay.
That may not be a board game.
That's fine. I like board games.
Did you send me that? Who sent me that Twitter thread recently that was like, for being a post-scarcity hologram society and all this stuff, Star Trek sure is into a lot of board games.
Yes, I did see that.
That you?
Yeah. I think somebody posted it in the Philosophers in Space group. But yes,
yeah, that was good.
And
another good reason to be in the Philosophers in Space group, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I generally am genuinely sad that when people think about liberal post-scarcity utopia, they think of Star Trek and not the culture. I think that we'd be in a much better place if the culture was sort of the most widely known touchstone for this particular part of the future landscape.
Wow, yeah. Well, we're discussing Player of Games today and for the foreseeable future, depending on how many episodes Aaron squeezes out of it. It's a book that I read, for sure.
You really pause so, after every time you say that.
Yeah, I just want credit for reading a book. I mean, that's hard. How many people
I know
have read a book?
You're not even a mind. You're just a normal humanoid. Like, you had to read it normie version.
I want to know how many books the average person actually reads per year versus how many they say they read per year. Because I'm just honest about it. I went through a lot of my 20s where it would be zero books per year, like literally.
Mm-hmm.
But then I started, I started reading more, got a little better. But like, seriously, how much do people read?
Yeah, I don't know. There was a time in undergrad and such where I didn't get to read a lot of books because I was reading a lot of stuff for class.
Right, yeah. You're an elite. You're part of the coastal elite.
That's true. I don't read. It's just kind of part of my cultural DNA.
Just have to read several books. But anyway, so I read Player of Games. Interesting. I mean, we have a lot of episode to do, so I guess I'll save a lot of my thoughts, but tell you this much going into it. I never at any time knew what was going to happen in this book.
Nice.
And I don't know. And I don't know why. I'm not saying that was like amazing or anything. It wasn't like, oh, what's going to happen? It was more like I just could never get myself into the mindset of this writer, I guess. I was like, oh, where's he? Okay, he's going this way with it. And then I was like, no. Oh, okay. I guess he's going. I'm not saying it's like a real cliffhanger-y kind of thing, you know, not really that. I just, for whatever reason, I just never expected whatever this was going to be. And it was interesting. So at the very least, it's not predictable. It's different than stuff I've read, I'll tell you that.
That's very much of the culture as I am interpreting it so far. It seems like being sort of weird in that kind of way is what you would hope of stories about this particular society that we'll be discussing.
Oh, well, and I guess we'd better hop on into our exposition zone. Punch it, Brian!
Relevant sound effect.
You're traveling through another dimension, beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the Exposition Zone.
All right, this Exposition Zone will be a 5-year journey across space because we'll have to learn all there is to know to play the great game that is the rest of the episode. Yeah, so what am I trying to explain for this one? Just the culture?
Yeah, I think for this episode, we'll focus in on the we got to set the board up. You know, we got to put the teams on either side, and then we'll play the game. So we want to explain.
And then we let the Wookiee win. That's a different.
another liberal dystopia that doesn't stand up to the culture. They're just knocking down like dominoes. Let's talk about the culture itself. What is your, I'm curious because I think,
Let's at least set up the very beginning, okay. Right? I mean, we got a guy who is a player of games. He's a gamer, mm-hmm. does a lot of gaming.
Gamer guy.
And you get the sense, and so I've only read this book, and apparently the culture is prevalent in many of these books by Ian Banks. So I won't know as much about the culture as, say, one coastal elite, Aaron Rabinowitz.
I've only read this one book. I just want to point that out.
Oh.
I've done additional background reading so that I'm a little bit more elite.
So you're just a knuckle dragger like me. You're not an elite.
Let it be known, our audience is prepared to tell us all of the things we're about to get wrong because we haven't read all 10 of the books yet.
Well, he's a player of games, and it seems as though there's an industry around this, although we don't get that much detail, but I get the sense that in this post-scarcity world where, you know, people don't really want for much in this world, that being a player of games, being a gamer is a perfectly respectable profession.
Not unlike in Star Trek.
In Star Trek?
I said not unlike in Star Trek, right? Where they also play board games all the time. It's something about post-scarcity society.
Oh, but
society,
this is like
right?
lots of different games, no. though. Star Trek is kind of like, they just, you know, the captain plays three-dimensional chess with a, you know, Geordi or whatever.
No, they have much better really games like in whole... the culture, I'll give you that.
Although, what's the... move along home. Oh my god,
Telemarine.
That was the worst. So bad. Move along home. Wow, I forgot about that. Let's do that one again. Hold on, quick detour.
It's okay, we're doing another home. NASA on no. Star Trek soon, so don't worry.
And by the way, I have watched all of Picard, another side note, and I like that show quite a lot.
Okay.
So maybe we can do something on that. But anyway, so player of games, and he's a gamer, and there's a lot of things hints you get about this post-scarcity society and this is known as the culture, I guess. Some number of people in this universe are the culture and some other people aren't, I guess. I don't know. It's like, is it like the Empire and Star Wars?
It's one of multiple top-level advanced societies within this universe.
But it's like it extends across.
Its boundaries are non-specific because it is a liberal anarchist utopia.
Well, I mean, it makes sense. Like it's kind of on the internet, I guess, too. Like that's part of it is like playing games with each other.
In a sense.
And so... And there's also, I mean, this is just, I think it's ticking all of Aaron's boxes because it's just transhumanist.
Oh, did you notice that? Did you notice that all of my kinks are in one society?
Yeah. There's, I mean, people are transgender to any degree they want to be. A lot of people, like, I guess in this world that Ian Banks is building, people like, maybe they start as one gender, live that way for a while, decide, I want to birth a baby or something, and they change gender. It's a very transhumanist. People don't seem to care about like what form they're in particular taking. And so they change around. It's your dream, right? Yeah. It's your utopia. Just be whatever.
Yeah.
Look however you want. Be however you want.
And we'll talk about some of the limits that appear to exist, or at least not limits because there are no laws in the culture, but at least cultural norms around the limits of transhumanism. Mm. But it is by far the most effectively transhumanist thing we've read so far.
Hmm. I don't really know laws. I didn't remember that.
He mentions it when he's talking to one of the guys in the Azad Empire. He says that they're genuinely, and like we'll discuss that because in a sense there are kind of laws, but they're not sort of emphasized as laws.
Is the idea that once you are truly post-scarcity,
nobody has any reason to do anything bad ever again.
Yeah, Which I don't know that that's entirely true, but certainly would be more true.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's still going to be, mm-hmm. you know, but I don't know. Who knows? Anyway. So that's the sense you get, you know, people can be whatever, do whatever. And as far as the story goes, this player of games is tempted by an there's like a secret. No, there's definitely laws because there's all this stuff about. Yeah, that can't be right. There's definitely laws because there's all this stuff about the secret like guild and all that.
Yep.
That's there's like a government, operating.
There's secrecy. There's all. But they technically will say there's no laws, strictly speaking. There are things that people will stop you from doing if you try to do them repeatedly. I'm just telling you what they say.
Yeah. So there are laws essentially.
there are some things that I would recognize as laws. Yes, that I think are effectively laws.
And this this secret gaming organization, he doesn't want. It's interesting because they set up kind of in the beginning. They set up this idea that Gergay, the main character, he is very tempted to cheat, and he actually does cheat in a game, which mm-hmm. is like. Not a no, you know, yeah. And apparently that's a law or something. That's a heavy norm because he's risking something to do that, and he's risking his reputation and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And they set that up, and I don't really know what the point of it is because I thought it was going to come into play later, but it doesn't really come into play. Well, it just sets up this plot where this out of control droid. So this is cool. I actually like this. There's a bunch of drones. Yeah, exactly. There's drones. This was written in 1988, by the way. So in this, it's like drones have they're sentient mm-hmm. people, yep. basically. And I really like it that they're talked about as people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're reading for a while, you kind of even forget like, oh, that character is a drone.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yep.
it's cool. I like it. They have personalities. They interact. They play key roles in the plot and all that. And it's kind of cool that it's like, well, that's a drone. I completely forgot about it by the end of the book that, you know, it comes into play in different times. But and the ship also is sentient. His ship is sentient, which we'll get to. Everything's basically what isn't sentient.
Well, so there are non-sentient drones as well, or non-sentient sort of servant entities, which I want to talk about some in the potential right. cons. And yeah, I want to. They don't make it as clear in this particular story that they do mention a couple times in this story that there's a distinction between drones and what are called mines with a capital M. So mines are super intelligent, high level artificial consciousness. They are hyperdimensional. They live in hyperspace. They're partly existing as 4D entities in hyperspace, so as they can get around the laws of the speed of light for the sake of faster computation. They run the big stuff in culture, and then the drones are like people who just live in the culture and are very, very smart, but are not orders of magnitude smarter the way that the minds are.
Huh. Cool. So there's a renegade drone that was like kicked out of this club.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, this gaming chess club. And
the Secret Service.
This
yes,
renegade drone. Yeah. And the renegade drone is like, helped Gergay cheat in this game to try to achieve this thing that I can't remember the terminology, but some sort of like perfect score kind of thing on a game.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, that'll be cool. Nobody's ever done this. And he's like, well, I can tell you the other cards that people have or something like that to some degree. So he tries to cheat and he doesn't end up getting the perfect score thing, but the drone uses that to blackmail him. And he says, I want to get back into the secret chess club. That is a super secret thing for some reason. And he's like, you got to do what I say. And so that kind of sets up the plot.
Yep.
And eventually that ends up in him. The Secret Chess Club wants him to go to Azad, which is this planet that's the whole thing is built around a game, which sounds great.
Uh-huh.
I think it's all one planet, though.
Well,
right?
No, they're the Empire of Azad.
Oh no, you're right because yeah. they have the fire planet. I'm sorry. Yeah, it is the Empire. They have a whole separate gaming planet that they have. It's pretty cool that they go to
just
for like the finals.
Yeah, for finals.
If you make it far enough, yeah. you get to go to the fire planet where Darth Vader died.
Which is as cool as impractically it sounds.
Yeah. It's a high budget game. Their whole culture. Well, we'll get to that later. Yeah. The Empire is all about the game. You want to talk about the culture, which is not all about. They're the opposite of that. Right. So that sets us all up where the guy is kind of blackmailed into, you know, talking to the culture to get a job for this drone, I guess. Mm-hmm. And in the process of doing so, he's hooked by this idea that he could go to this whole planet system or whatever, this empire, where all they care about is this game, this super complex game. Mm-hmm. Just like, I mean, it's like, what would it even be? I mean, it's like Risk times chess or something, you know, it's just like insane variables.
It's Axis and Allies cubed. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Diplomacy, but with also pieces and stuff.
We'll talk about the game in great detail. It's such a cool game. We will talk about the game later. I love it so much. I wish I could play it. I honestly do.
Okay, and so that sets us all up. And the culture is, again, because I've only read this book, and apparently so is this loser sitting across from me who's only read this one. The culture isn't talked about all that much, but it's just kind of, you know, you get little glimpses of it here and there based on, you know, the internal monologue and stuff of the main character. So that's kind of where we are in the plot for this first episode. Mm-hmm. And the culture, I suppose, is the Federation in a sense. It's the post-scarcity society that's like cross-planetary, all this stuff. So what more do you want to say about the culture for now?
Yeah, I mean, I would characterize it as a liberal / libertarian anarchist socialist AI utopia. I think those are the key features. So the reason I pointed out the mines in particular is that the mines are the most important feature of this society, because they, through their incredibly advanced computational abilities, allow for the post-scarcity and allow for the sort of idyllic living of everyone within the culture, as well as the long-term preservation of the culture against outside risks. So they're the deus ex machina.
Are they our robot overlords, essentially?
They are 100% our robot overlords. And one of the major concerns about the culture is that it achieves utopia by essentially turning humans into pets, because we're not involved much with the high level decision making, because we're, you know, just orders of magnitudes dumber than the mines in every kind of way.
Yeah, but I'm okay with that. I for one welcome our robot overlords. If I got to have the life of my cat, that'd be friggin' awesome.
Yeah, and I think,
get to complain about, I've already just been fed and I get to complain about being fed again. Like the minute I'm fed.
Yeah, you and I are both sort of liberal technocrats, so like this is very much our wet dream.
Yeah,
And that's.
And by the way, I go to the bathroom in a box, but if I miss the box, it's not like anything happens to me.
No, a non-sentient
someone else cleans it up.
Comes along and cleans it up. Yeah, pretty much exactly how this works.
Some poor mind, I guess, in the comparison would have.
Well,
to
no,
clean it up.
Because in this world they achieve, in the culture they achieve maximum utility by only having non-sentient entities do the bad work, and sentient
entities
are completely
free. How do I get one of those? That's my Roomba.
That's your Roomba.
Except the Roomba.
Yes, exactly.
When the Roomba meets cat crap, that's not a good combination.
No,
actually, they're not built for that yet.
Actually, I just wanted to highlight, since we've been doing a lot of crossover conversations that are great. I did an episode specifically on AI utopia on Embrace the Void. It was episode 115, where I did a book where a guy talked about laying out the theories of what an AI utopia would look like. And it does in many ways resemble the culture, in the sense that the idea of work is kind of abolished, that like non-sentient entities do everything that counts as work, and sentient beings are freed up to do whatever they want all the time. So it's a primarily hedonistic culture. This comes through informally in this particular story, but like the goal of people living in the culture is to have fun rather than to be useful or productive in any kind of way. So that's why games are a big thing in this culture, is because like, you know,
let's get there already, everybody.
I'm just totally selling you on this.
I've signed on.
Yeah. And one other thing I want to highlight about it is that it is sometimes it's a direct democracy. You don't see it in this particular story, but like when the culture goes to war, they go to war via a universal direct democracy vote. So humans are involved in that level of the decision making, but it is the kind of direct democracy where the government, in the form of the mines, withholds information in a variety of ways, as we see in this particular story where the mines have been not telling the people of the culture about the Empire of Azad because they want to handle it themselves rather than have people try to intercede in some kind of way, because they won't prevent members of the culture from like going and interacting with this other group. So instead, they just don't give them the information. Still on board, still totally with it. Like,
yeah,
you're like,
I'm with it.
Just NSA me, it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, well, okay, if we had the culture, mm-hmm. how would the Iraq war have looked like?
No, I mean, look, I'm with you. Like, that's why I'm saying I want this to be better, like, more well-known than Star Trek. So the things I want to talk about with the culture is sort of all of the things they use to bring about this kind of internal utopia, and then issues and potential costs, which will set us up for their interactions with other cultures in the next episode. So like you mentioned, they have a kind of, so first of all, the most important thing about this society is that they've solved the alignment problem with regard to AI. That's the key linchpin here, is that there's this very...
How do they do that? Can we cheat off of their
That's the thing where if you could figure that out, we'd be set. And like the gap between us and culture is basically creating super intelligent beings that are both benevolent towards humans and not too odd. Which is to say,
not too odd.
Yes. Some of the minds, think about it, right? You have these super, super, super orders of magnitude smarter beings, right?
Right.
How do you keep them from not getting really weird, right? Not getting sort of a view of reality that's completely detached from our on the ground, normal human being level view of reality.
Well, I'd put it another way. I think it's that we have a totally skewed view of reality.
Right.
And how do we keep super intelligent minds to also have our weird view of reality?
Right. Because if they're going to be benevolent towards us, right, they have to care about our weird view of reality. So they have to understand us, which is, and that's part of the reason that humans still exist in the culture, is because the minds find humans a little fascinating as weird creatures that can sometimes achieve knowledge that they think is only really generally achievable through their higher levels of consciousness. Because they are programmed to be benevolent towards us, and it is the case sometimes that apparently some minds go a little bit odd, which is why I use that kind of language, which is their way of saying one of them gets a little bit out there in their judgments, which is a kind of libertarian anarchist way of saying maybe we're going to have to curtail your behavior a little bit here soon. But for the most part, they manage to care about humans in a way that allows for what seems like fairly optimal living for human beings. So that's the main feature of the culture. And then the other feature that you mentioned is the transhumanism, that they have this apex level transhumanism where you can like take on the form of other species. You can do whatever you want, essentially. Though one of the things that I found is that going from biological to AI is considered an unusual life choice.
How can you go from biological to
AI? Like uploading yourself, right, is an option in this universe, but it's considered unusual, which I just thought was just a funny way.
Wouldn't that be like you turning into a drone, pretty much?
Yeah, essentially. And I'm a little like...
Because you're not going to be a mind or anything because you're not smart enough.
Right. Though there's a way that separate individuals can come together to create something like a mind by combining their intelligence,
a hive mind
kind of thing. So there are various.
So you're saying if we get our cult together, we all upload.
Yep. Okay. You're picking up what I'm putting down. Yeah.
I don't know, but I don't think you want to go that route. I think you want to go the transhumanist route and stay like, you know,
separate
with your carnal desires.
Yes. No, you're not wrong about the carnal desire side of things at all. One other thing that I wanted to point out that gets casually dropped within the Player of Games story about the transhumanism stuff is the changing names is apparently weird within the culture. So you can change bodies, you can change species. People don't tend to change names very much, which I thought was a cool version of when everything else is totally flexible. This is the one thing that you keep constant so that you can have a sense of you persisting over time. But I also feel like, if we're being honest, right, in that situation, people would change their names in all sorts of crazy ways.
Yeah. Well, it might, I mean, if we're, it is a science fiction, so if we're talking about a future scenario where maybe we get to the point where gender is just totally divorced from names or something. Like, right. People don't associate, you know, masculine, feminine names or whatever. Maybe then it would make more sense that you care way less about changing your gender than you do about changing your name.
Yeah, and they make some really funny jokes about language and gender in this particular story, and we'll talk about it some more next time as well. But they sort of essentially say that they have, like, you know, they have a lot more terms for genders, but they don't use them directly a lot of the time because it's not important. But this ties into something else that I really wanted to talk about in this first episode, which is a callback to our episode on Arrival, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. I don't know if you remember that one, but
I do. Now, are we calling back or are we currently?
Oh, you're right. Arrival, we're constantly times. At the same time, both here and calling back.
And are we frustratingly doing a thing that's logically impossible that I'll argue with you forever about, or are we just calling?
Yeah, exactly. We're doing all those things simultaneously. So
the idea that was the idea that how you learn language impacts how you think about the world.
Oh, good instant, right? Simultaneous recollection. I'm impressed. Yes.
Well, I do. I'm an atemporal being that crosses.
Just
happen to remember that one.
Yeah, so the culture believes in the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. They believe that, like, the nature of your language shapes your consciousness, and they developed a devised language, like, they call it Marian, I think, or something like that, which is sort of designed to be kind of functionally perfect and allow for maximal flexibility of mind while ability to... you know, just like opens up your mind in the most numbers of ways. And this plays out in this particular story. It's also like a theme throughout the books that, like, other cultures adopt this as a lingua franca because it's such a perfect language. But like in this story, as the main character switches over from the culture language to what they call Iekic, which is the language of Azad, his thinking changes
it's like part of the game, kind of, is that the people of Azad grow up around this game thinking about it, you know, the whole culture revolves around it. So the idea is that the language also kind of gives you insights about it, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, it could change how you think.
And a little bit of maybe, you know, like, not spoiler, but teaser, right? This plays an important role in the climax of the story. How he comes to find his way through partly involves coming back to the culture's language. So I thought that was another really cool feature. Not to mention, like, it's a really funny story for all the cracks about language and personal pronouns, given that, like, as you'll see in the next episode, Azad is kind of a stand-in for American culture and, like, you know, 20th century imperial cultures. They make a lot of funny jokes that have played very well in the modern social, that have aged well in the modern social justice pronoun wars society. Okay, so, and I just want to also point out one thing, which in all of that brilliance, one critique I have of this particular story is that the main character, Gurga, is very heteronormative. He appears to only have stayed male, or tends to only stay male, and only tends to be interested in people who code as female. And, you know, I'm not saying you can't do that, I'm just saying it would have been interesting to have a little bit more diversity in that part of the story.
Yeah,
I don't know if you caught that as well.
I didn't necessarily catch that. He had never changed.
I don't think you hear anything about him ever having changed or anything like that, or him having.
Well, maybe it's part of the fact that, you know, spoilers. Mm-hmm. He's got but one purpose,
and then, the playing of the games.
He came here to change genders and play games, and he's all out of gender. Something like that. Like, he doesn't. Yeah. He's so here to play games that he hasn't cared about it, I guess.
He is diverse in ways that we will discuss in the next episode that put him in contrast with Azad, but it is not this particular vector on which he is particularly diverse. So, okay. So I want to talk about the costs and the benefits now in the time that we have left, right? Is this a utopia? You're on board, right? So the benefit sides are obvious. High levels of flourishing for all sentient beings involved, high respect for autonomy, right? On a number of the factors that we've talked about that are most important, I think, on ethical judgments, it seems to rate really highly on almost all of them, right? Like, they really are maxing out the score as far as I can tell. So what are the costs then, right? Well, the first concern is a big problem with utopias, generally speaking, is that, you know, if for it to be a utopia, it has to answer hard questions of ethics. And there are hard questions that may not be sort of perfectly answerable, even if you could then implement the answers perfectly. So one thing I found out, for example, is that physical deformity is almost non-existent within the culture. And it's only ever as a result of deliberate action that somebody is physically deformed. And it's generally considered in poor taste to engage in that kind of physical deformity, which, calling back to our very, very recent episodes about these kinds of issues, like, I think it's funny that we keep backdooring our way into eugenics as a way to create the perfect utopia, because one of the other main features that the minds bring about in the culture is genofixing, which is the all of these benefits that people get in terms of their biology because they can correct for the genome. Including my most beloved reason that I'm totally 100% on board with this culture, which is the glands, the drug-secreting glands that allow you to enhance your various experiences. I have a feeling
that would be your favorite, you pervert.
Oh my God, I want it so badly. But I'm a little bit more...
Yeah, they can administer drugs just naturally, right? Like at all times.
Yeah, they can administer all sorts of skill and experience enhancing drugs in a variety of ways. They can also turn off pain whenever they want to. As you said, they can change.
Yeah, we need to get a hold of that. That's step one.
Yeah, turning off pain.
In terms of what we need to do to get to the culture, I know there's a long way, but in any big endeavor, you got to divide it into small steps. Step one, figure that out. Because, like, come on. Mm-hmm. It's unreasonable how much pain we have to deal with for no reason.
Well, so that brings...
As a species.
Yeah, that brings with it another major problem, which is if the culture is really so perfect, and they talk about this some in this book, where, like, there's no fear of death or severe harm, does that take away certain benefits that come as a result of those?
I don't care.
Yeah, I know that you don't care, but I have to go through the motions, right? Sure. I have to lay out all the sides.
I won't stop you. I'll let you.
No, it's fine. It's good that you chime in with your lack of concern.
Does it take away something that is to be human to not get food poisoning and shit yourself on the toilet all 24 hours in a row? Are we losing something when we... lose the idea that we're gonna just like eat something slightly bad and then just barf, just diarrhea?
So
those are the great questions
ponder. You're saying you're not moved by the argument. Is that what you're telling me? Shall I move on?
I'm just saying, like, usually in these philosophical discussions, you keep it like an idealized version of something, like, oh, you're lifting weights and, you know, it feels like a little bit of resistance to build them. I'm saying, nah, screw that. You bang your pinky toe on something and you're in the hospital. Like, we don't need that. We don't need that.
But how can you know what it's like to be truly alive if you've never, ever feared death? No.
Can we replace that? Yeah, I mean, okay, fear of death is one thing.
I mean, there is that. Yeah, but we have, like, talked about that some before. That, like, go ahead.
Like paper cuts.
Yeah. No,
I'm just saying. There's a long list of things we don't need, and nobody would miss. Yeah. There's no, like, the exhilaration you got when dealing with paper without gloves or something. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not a big.
No, I understand, and they do say that, like, luck and heartache still exist in this world, in the culture. So there is still some of the kinds of...
Well, and he's still very worried about losing his reputation, right, exactly, when he might be outed as a cheater. That's a bit like reputational stuff. I feel like that's...
Yeah. No.
It's kind of the same in Star Trek, too. And like in post-scarcity worlds, like reputation becomes the currency, you know? And so people... And I think that... You know, I'm sure there's, as with everything, there's downsides and upsides, but I think there's good upside to that too. Like, if it really mattered to everybody, like, oh, my word matters, or my, you know, if I'm talked about as somebody who does good things or is courageous or is compassionate or whatever it may be, it would be cool for that to matter more rather than, you know, what matters for most people is, oh, I don't have health insurance and I can't pay the bills. Like, I don't blame people for, like, you know, if their ethics might sometimes be put on the back burner because they can't afford to like pay for a hospital bill.
I get it.
I don't really blame people.
Yeah. No, I mean, I get what you're saying. And like, you know, I had these notes of like, these are the flaws with this particular system, which are like humans become pets for AIs and everything becomes kind of a game.
And that's my kink.
and like, you know, I put them down because they will be important for the journey of Gurga as a character through going through Azad. So it's important because we're going to talk about it some more in future episodes, but I'm not saying that I'm necessarily hugely compelled by any of these concerns.
Don't let me stop you.
No, you're fine.
I'll still be, it's like in the labyrinth when they fall down that thing and the walls are talking. They're like, oh, don't go there. He's like, all right, cool it. You know, he's like, oh, but it's been so long. Can I just say the thing? It's so good. It's like that. You can go ahead. Feel free. I don't mean to stop you.
So here's another one that
might don't expect a big reaction.
Right? Well, so here's one as a consequentialist that might get its hooks in you a little bit better, which is the culture's ideology as a libertarian, liberal, anarchist commune puts limits on how they impact other cultures. So in this particular context, right, we are going to find out that the culture has known for 70 plus years about a society that is incredibly horrible and abusive and violent and causes massive harm to lots and lots of people, and has quietly let it continue because they wanted to deal with it in a way that was suitably subtle and neoliberal.
Yeah.
And like, basically, and this is something interesting that I found in an additional reading, in this universe, they have what they call hegemonic swarms. So think of when we talked about Blindsight, Rorschach, or...
I know what those words mean, but I don't really understand how they would go together.
Well, so let me tie it all together for you, right? So you remember our friend the gray goo, right? The beings that like try to turn everything into copies of themselves or try to like transform the whole universe into one big computer or something like that. These are what... Or species like Hive, species like the Borg. These are all categorized in the culture as hegemonic swarms. Beings that try to combine everything together in their one unified hegemony.
And is it basically like this galaxy is not big enough for the two of us? Like those things can't really exist peacefully,
right? And there's a subset of contact of special operations that's job is to deal with von Neumann probes, essentially, right? Deal with entities and various things that like try to turn the whole universe into a gray goo. They're not a huge threat, but they are of concern in the universe. And the reason I bring it up is because the culture is particularly concerned with not, in effect, becoming a hegemonic swarm by, you know, forcing its liberal utilitarian, you know, like post-scarcity views on everyone else in the universe. So they have a kind of not actual prime directive, but like an informal version of that where they try to not be too big footprinty about their engaging with other cultures. So instead you get stuff like what happens in Players of Game, very subtle moves to try to bring about positive change within the universe. But that's a very incrementalist approach, and some folks might feel like they should take a much more active interventionist approach.
You used neoliberal to describe that, but I don't know if that's right. I mean, at least the way like people think of neoliberalism, at least in this today's context, as being more interventionalist, I think, than...
I probably should avoid using that term because it means a lot of different things. But one way I think of neoliberal is the like, we're going to convert China by tying them into a global economic system rather than invading them. That it's the soft power rather than the physical military power. Though the culture does go to war in some cases, they tend to really try to avoid it. So, I mean, you could say that that's just more of a like classically liberal view in a sense. They're trying.
No, you're probably right. I think it's the problem is with the term and how many people use it differently for different things. You know? But we are plumb out
we
of time.
Sure are.
So we'll definitely have to save more for later. Yeah. So we can give the quick teaser for next week, and then we're going to be talking about Player of Games.
Woo! Be reading this book. It's a really brilliant book. I can't recommend it enough.
I read it.
You did, and you liked it, right? You were like, you sent me the usual, Thomas is like, I'm not really getting into this text, and then like, okay, it's actually not terrible text.
I wasn't at first. It wasn't grabbing me.
You good placed it,
this
is what
one's
I'm saying.
Fine.
You totally good placed it.
I don't know.
It.
No, I wouldn't put that in that category at all.
Fair enough.
No. And Good Place was weirdly, I just had was resistant to it because, and I actually have talked to a lot of people who were this way because it seems like it's going to be one thing and then it's, you know, it's another. Whereas this was just, it wasn't grabbing me at first. And I don't know. I liked it, but I don't know. I wasn't super in love with it.
It deeply attaches
we'll talk
me
about more
as
after
a
dark.
Board game player, I think is the issue.
Okay. We can talk about that after dark. And also we've got to let the patrons make you say stuff, so go ahead.
Yeah, thanks to our 25 tier strong AI patrons, Chad T, Dude, Is It Ethical to Discriminate Against Viruses, Corey Ebert, Winchesters Never Die, Atlantis Is My Favorite Stargate, Universe Is a Distant Last, Announcing PSI Episode 100, Anathem Live in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, Sweet Dream, I Believe in You. And of course, Anathem. And all the thanks, top tier, super utils, utility maximizer thanks to Would You Kindly Sub to Zero GP. Thank you all so very much.
All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Hop on to patreon.com/zero G. Catch us after dark. We'll talk about all kinds of fun stuff. Like, I don't know. Changing your species and stuff.
Incest.
I'm sure.
We're going to talk about incest. Weird,
it'll be some weird sex thing.
Yeah, you got it right. I mean, incest. It. We're doing sex things.
Okay. Aaron and I are going to do sex things after dark. All right. We'll see you there.
I love that after dark has turned into a thirst trap.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zero G, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
Bored with utopia? Well, have we got the neoliberal mission for you?
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zero G. You can find us on Twitter at Zero G Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.